This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight, on the 45th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, Barack Obama will accept his party's nomination for president, making him the first African-American to receive a major party's nomination for that position. It's difficult for many Americans to talk about how race figures into politics, but it's not hard for my guest, Mark Sawyer. He directs the Center for the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Politics at UCLA, where he's also an associate professor of African American Studies and Political Science. Mark Sawyer, welcome to Fresh Air. What significance do you think it has in American history to have an African American as the nominee of a major party?
It's a huge significance. It means that the way we think about ourselves as Americans may be changing dramatically. African Americans have been on the outside looking in sometimes this American story, or in some ways a kind of pariah, or, I mean, to use Du Bois' term, double consciousness, sort of in the outside looking in, or vice versa. So therefore, it means that African Americans may, or we may begin to think of ourselves much more as a part of the American story, a central part, than we've been given credit for in the past.
Can I ask what the personal significance is to you that an African American is accepting his party's nomination for president?
Yeah, I mean, I think, the night that it was clear that he was going to be the nominee, I was doing an interview with a radio show in London. I think I was almost in tears, and I said, I've never felt so American as today, as if America might have embraced me. And that's difficult because oftentimes a lot of African Americans have struggled with their patriotism because of the legacy of slavery and racism. Particularly, even as a political scientist, I'm aware that flag waving has sometimes been associated with negative feelings about the other, including African Americans, immigrants, and others. And that's a discernible thing that we can find in actual data.
What kind of data are you referring to?
Well, in public opinion data, in particular, whites who express high levels of patriotism frequently express high levels of anti-black racism. You wouldn't think that the things are necessarily automatically associated with one another, but there is. That is, their love of America has been constructed under the idea, and frequently either a conscious or subconscious idea, that America is a white nation and needs to stay that way. And so they tend to express a kind of distaste for the other the more that they love America. And there's a huge literature on this that basically shows this time and time again.
Now, you mentioned patriotism. Michelle Obama has been accused of being unpatriotic of comments that you made about America. So how do you interpret the use of that word in the context of the campaign?
Yeah, I think there's a debate between two kinds of patriotism. One is a kind of patriotism saying, I love America, right or wrong, no matter what it does. And even the sort of Rush Limbaugh characters, who are always sort of critical of America, right? America's on the wrong track, still claim that kind of patriotism. Another is a kind of critical patriotism, which is the project that is America is a work in progress, and we are struggling to live up to our best values as embodied by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and people like Martin Luther King and Benjamin Franklin and Frederick Douglass or Susan B. Anthony, and that a kind of patriotism that says, I love my country enough to struggle to help it to become what it might be, that sort of beacon on a hill. And I think that kind of patriotism has frequently been criticized and attacked, and was the kind that Michelle was expressing when she said, this is a time I feel very proud of our country, the first time I feel very proud of our country. She was saying that the sort of upwelling of support, the love for someone by so many people, of someone who's different than them, made her feel very proud, in which she frequently had seen the opposite of that.
Barack Obama represents a younger generation of American leaders and of African American leaders. He will be accepting his party's nomination on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Would you reflect a little bit about differences in the issues for those two generations of leaders?
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't be more profound. I mean, on one hand, there's one set of issues that have largely been sort of taken off the table, which was the sort of one central aim of what Martin Luther King cited as the freedom struggle was civil rights. Civil rights were accomplished with the 64, 65 acts that provided for public accommodations, voting rights, et cetera. Now the struggle is about what part will African Americans and largely people of color more generally play in the American story? What will be the terms of their inclusion moving forward into the 21st century? There's been a very complicated response. Incarceration is up. Poverty still remains a problem. The question is on what terms will we be a part of this American story? How much can we, to what degree will we be able to embrace it? What will be our central role? And will we have a more interdependent and connected future across racial lines? And in fact, right now, the current thing is that my argument is that if African-Americans and Latinos, America is dependent upon them. The future of America depends upon, as by, 2042, the census says that there will be no majority group. Minorities will be such a large part of the American landscape.
During the Democratic primary, Hillary Clinton ran a historic candidacy, as a woman who was getting so close to getting her party's nomination. And she made being a woman a focal point of that campaign. Now, Barack Obama was also in a historic situation on the verge of getting his party's nomination. But he didn't make being African-American a focal point of his campaign in the way that Hillary made being a woman a focal point of hers. Do you think that there would have been a difference focusing on his race for him as, compared to Hillary focusing on her gender?
Well, it would have been a disaster for him to have run explicitly as a black candidate, talking about race issues frequently. That tends to scare voters. In fact, political scientists have a term that we call deracialized campaigns, in which black candidates seek to pursue campaign strategies where they don't emphasize race or racial difference. Think about the contrast of someone like a Sharp James or a Coleman Young in Detroit who talked about racial empowerment. But for the most part, black candidates who need to get white votes for a long time have not wanted to racialize their campaigns. They've tried to use universal appeals generally and have to. The question is whether the campaign gets racialized for them. But especially given the gender breakdown of the Democratic primary, it was a plus for Hillary Clinton to particularly use the gender issue as a way of getting support and emphasizing the historic nature of her candidacy and particularly pulling in the kind of second wave feminist ethos into her campaign.
There have been times when Barack Obama has been accused of playing the race card. You have a great definition, by the way, I should ask you for, about the race card.
Yeah. So the race card comes from O.J.'s lawyer, Robert Shapiro, when he said about the O.J. trial that we played the race card and we played it from the bottom of the deck. And I guess from what that meant is that it's a sort of get out of jail free card. It's that when an African-American is facing some criticism, if there is such a thing as a race card, they're supposed to be believed that they can sort of claim that the critique is or the criticism is somehow racist. And therefore, it disappears. It sort of stops whites in their tracks. It's sort of a version of garlic and a cross to a vampire or something. And it's generally perceived to be used as a kind of tactic to blunt what would otherwise be fair criticism. The problem is no such thing exists, especially in the context of a political campaign. Any week when Barack Obama is talking about race or racism is a week in which he's losing, because talking about that issue cues for whites his racial difference. And you can see that reflected in the polls. One of the campaign tactics that his campaign has sometimes fallen into but been baited into is to get them talking about race. And it's tough because they have to, in some ways, inoculate themselves from very sort of subtle uses of race that play on unconscious fears and prejudices and make them conscious for voters, but at the same time, not turn the dialogue to being about race in a way that will turn off white voters and make him sort of the black candidate and not able to have a universal appeal.
Now, you said that you like a candidate like Barack Obama can't play the race card because to talk directly about race will be a losing battle. Like an African-American candidate who needs a white vote to can't win that way. Now, what about, say, Clarence Thomas? Now, I know he wasn't running for a popular vote, but when he was going through his confirmation hearings for Supreme Court justice, some of his critics said that he emphasized his autobiography and the racial aspects of his autobiography to inoculate himself against criticism because his critics risked sounding like racists.
Right. And he also, well, he even used the comment that he was the victim of a high-tech lynching.
Exactly.
And he played race against gender, which was the line of attack, which was that he had engaged in a certain kind of he had sexually harassed Anita Hill, literally. And so what Clarence Thomas was doing, and when an African-American strikes that, but in the context of a conservative conversation, which is to say, I'm black and I don't buy into those things that other black people do. So racism has not ruled my life. Racism has been this thing that I've consistently overcome and been able to move aside. And in fact, Barack Obama frequently, in the way that he talks about race, tries to talk about race in a way of overcoming, transcending, or weaving the struggle for racial equality into the fabric of the American narrative, in such a way that Martin Luther King and Frederick Douglass and abolitionists become sort of founding fathers alongside the Jeffersons, the Franklins, and the Washingtons, in a sort of sense of perfecting a more inclusive America. So there's two very different uses. It's not as if he doesn't use race at all, but it's that talking specifically or hurling accusations about sort of white racism or calling the candidate or your opponent a racist plays very poorly.
Let me quote something for you. This was an op-ed in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution by Cynthia Tucker. And she wrote about how the Obama's narratives have brought new kinds of personal narratives into national politics. She wrote, "Win or lose, Obama's campaign has already changed the nation's racial dynamic, if only by highlighting the accomplishments of the black middle class." I wonder if you agree with her on that.
Yes, but I mean, we also had the Cosby Show that kind of highlighted the accomplishments of the black middle class, which was, you know, probably one of the number one shows in the 80s. And I think it kind of continues that narrative. One thing I will say that I think
was a TV show.
Yeah, it wasn't entirely real, so people could dismiss it. But there was some evidence that, in particular, whites did really think it was real and sort of wondered why there were so many black poor people when the Cosbys were doing so well. But on Michelle's speech Monday, I thought the one thing that was really startling was an African-American love story that we don't see frequently in Hollywood. The way she talked about their courtship, their family, the way they fell in love with one another. We don't often see that in Hollywood or elsewhere. There very rarely are black actors even paired together to tell a story of a romantic character. And so her speech was almost striking in that Barack Obama was playing a romantic lead in a sense, and then sort of transfers into kind of father's knows best, you know, a stable father, family man. But the beginning of the story was about him, you know, playing the sort of guy trying to get the girl that we don't often see in sort of in African-Americans in Hollywood and elsewhere on television.
Tell me what else you heard in Michelle Obama's speech on Monday that you're not used to hearing as part of the political discourse.
I guess her willingness to really have to explain her background, not just tell a story or tell how wonderful, but that she had to try and gin up a sense to make people understand where she comes from by being very vivid in the description. But she also had to simultaneously really, it was an extraordinary tightrope act, avoid any sense of Black anger. So particularly when she talked about her father and his working through MS and being a city worker, that there were just a set of expectations that she had that she would do well and that her and her brother would struggle and work hard to get ahead. But that she didn't really talk about any sense of kind of impediment or struggle. So it was just an interesting tightrope act. And just some of the things. I mean, there's some evidence that just the sort of very her height, her physicality is she's a very striking woman, both in the way she stands. It's going to be interesting to see how that the speech that appeared on Monday plays in the context of the broader convention, because it was designed to appeal to the emotion of Democrats and to create an emotional connection and empathy with the Obama family, including bringing out the daughters in the very unscripted moment. But there may be an empathy gap.
You said that you thought that Michelle Obama consciously tried to avoid expressing anything that would sound like Black anger. She has been accused by people on the right of being angry. Why is, you use a phrase like Black anger. What does that phrase mean to you? What are the implications of it?
Well, the implications of it is an African-American who sees racism as something that has dominated their lives, largely by, this is probably largely in the white imagination, and wants to exact some kind of revenge. Nat Turner, for instance, for having experienced that, or even the kind of comments about the LJ jury, that they were somehow taking revenge on whites for all of the sort of injustices that they've experienced. And writing about this goes all the way back. I mean, Thomas Jefferson suggested that blacks might not be fit to be citizens because of the rage of having experienced slavery. And it's one of those things that cues concern and mistrust amongst whites. And she specifically tried to avoid it. She talked about working hard. She talked about overcoming poverty and her father's kinds of illnesses. But she didn't really talk about any experiences of race or racism growing up. And so it was a kind of tightrope act to talk about, to present struggle and not being spoon-fed without portraying it in an angry way.
You were talking about how whites perceive quote, Black anger as being threatening, as being like resentful, as maybe being about people who are looking for revenge against white people for injustices against Black. Do you think that makes it difficult for Barack Obama to wage a very aggressive campaign in fighting back against attack ads and other attacks against him from Republicans, out of fear that it might be perceived as the kind of, quote, Black anger that you were talking about?
I think it means that he cannot use the powerful emotions of fear and anger in his campaign because it might cue, or as well as indignation, because they might cue that kind of response or that kind of concern. He has to portray himself as kind of above that. Otherwise, he might become an angry Black man. And I think those who have sort of suggested that Obama go more aggressively on the attack don't always appreciate his concern for if he were to go on the attack in a very strident fashion, that he might cross over, that he would all of a sudden become and begin to look like Al Sharpton, no matter what he was saying.
You said that you thought maybe there would be an empathy gap in their response to Michelle Obama's speech. What do you mean by that? What are you thinking of?
Well, frequently, both in sort of social science issues, but also in other kinds of things, there's a kind of white resentment of Black success or struggle. So they don't feel a sort of sense of empathy with the struggle. They don't see themselves in the struggle. And in fact, there's the opposite reaction, which is there's resentment. So if hopefully, and just for the sense of kind of fairness, right, that speech would play as if a white person were giving it and would invoke a sort of empathetic reaction. One may politically disagree with Michelle and Barack Obama. But if there's an empathy gap, it'll mean that that speech, which talked about her struggle and their successes and their ability to become a kind of successful family and Barack Obama's rise as well as hers, might spur a kind of resentment among some whites.
Because?
Well, because it's perceived as being undeserved. They don't see themselves in that struggle. They don't see, and they see black success as being a result of affirmative action, government programs, handouts, special treatment, those kinds of things.
I thought it was interesting the way she talked about her mother saying to her when she went to college, you know, when Michelle went to college, that more college-educated children need to return home to the community. And that both, you know, Michelle and Barack Obama ended up doing that after leaving home to go to Ivy League schools.
Yeah, the quote from her mother was echoing a sense of service and racial uplift, but one that's perfectly consistent with some of the arguments of W.E.B. Du Bois and even Booker T. Washington, for that matter, and a long history of African-American tradition, but one that's ultimately non-threatening, right, which is the idea that you want to uplift, you want to encourage, you want to help build the African-American community as part of the entire American community.
So, you know, Barack Obama is not only the first African-American candidate to win his party's nomination, he's the first biracial candidate to win his party's nomination. And I wonder how you see the biracial aspect of his background as uniting and or dividing America in how it's being discussed. And how he's discussing it, how he's being attacked by opponents, and so on.
I think he actually uses it quite well in that he has a way of layering his identities that is very authentic, right? He simultaneously thinks of himself as wholly African American, but also biracial, very much identifies with his mother's family. The way people write about it sometimes can be quite shocking. I remember a piece in the Atlantic Monthly that talked about his mother taught him too well to express black rage, as if, you know, somehow, you know, that's there's no black mother that could ever teach him that, or, you know, to be well spoken and polite and those kinds of things. So it's a very strange way, but it also shows how much in operation the one drop rule is. I also wonder a little bit if the campaign might be different if his mother were still alive and with us.
What do you think about when you think of that?
Well, the idea that he would have her as a kind of articulate advocate to present his story and who he is. In particular to the large sort of the basic base of swing voters, which is older white women. In as much as you think about Michelle trying to be the Michelle Obama, trying to be the surrogate, thinking about his mother being the surrogate to those group of people, the woman who raised him, who would be a sort of white woman from that particular generation.
So any further thoughts before we have to wrap up about the historic significance of Barack Obama accepting his party's nomination and accepting it on the night of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech?
Well, where simultaneously he represents the first generation that grew up without Jim Crow. But at the same time, my great-grandfather was a slave. And it really marks both the sort of incredible set of progress that's been made in the context of the American story, but also speaks to in some ways, the strangeness of the moment. I think the war in Iraq, the flagging economy created an opening and change. These kinds of changes, at least in my research, don't happen slowly over time, but happen in huge convulsive shifts. And we may be on the brink of one.
Mark Sawyer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. I really enjoyed it.
Mark Sawyer directs the Center for the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Politics at UCLA, where he's also an associate professor of African American Studies and Political Science. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.